We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
All right, so if you're a teacher attending with your class today, what level are your students? All right, this is great. We see the numbers coming in. So this looks nice. This so looks like we're pretty evenly split between classes with middle school students and classes with high school students. Okay, that's great. Team, can you pull the poll down? All right, great. So today, this presentation, this live interview is with Medal of Honor recipient Robert E. Maxwell, who served during World War II. And the interview is going to be hosted by Kathy Ehlers-Metcalf, who's the Vice President of Education of the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege to be here with Mr. Maxwell, who is a World War II veteran. He joined the Army in 1942, and I would like to give our students a little perspective on that. His action for which he received the Medal of Honor happened 73 years ago tomorrow. 73 years. Many of us don't even get an opportunity to live that long. And so we have some wonderful perspective coming to us. I want to welcome, before we get started, some schools that have signed on. We have Emerald Ridge High School in Puyallup, Washington, Barrington High School, Riverside Homeschool Cooperative, Inspire Charter Academy. We have Pike County Schools in Kentucky, Loyal Middle School in Wisconsin. From Arizona, we have the Connections Academy. We have students with us, lots more from all over the country. So thank you for joining us today, and we'll be watching for your questions. We'll get to as many as we can, keeping in mind that I will and Noelle, who's working with us, will sort of blend together similar questions. So if you don't hear your exact question, just keep listening for one that might be a compilation of several schools that asked almost the same question. So thank you so much, Mr. Maxwell, for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
Your Medal of Honor citation, and students, a citation is a recording, a written record of the action for which a Medal of Honor recipient receives his award. So you can look up Mr. Maxwell's citation, if you have not already done so, on the Medal of Honor Society website or themedalofhonor.com. And you can also see a recorded living history with him there. But I noticed that your citation says that by your calmness, tenacity, and fortitude, you inspired your fellow soldiers to continue. And for all the years I've known you, calmness is one of the things that I've always noticed about you. Have you always been calm like this?
Yes, I think so. I do get excited about a few things, but I don't demonstrate a lot of excitement.
Okay. Well, you grew up, since I made a point of mentioning to the students that you got your Medal of Honor 73 years ago, you grew up in a time very different from how our students are growing up today.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about your growing up years and what it was that helped you grow into the person that you would become and be in the war?
Well, I had a kind of a unique method of starting out in life, and that's not, many people have experienced this, but when I was probably about, somewhere between 1 and 3, I don't know when, my mom and dad separated, and my dad sort of disappeared from my life, never heard from him again. Although I knew his relatives in Kansas where we lived, my mother was had a job with selling hosiery or house to house, and a traveling salesman. And so the judge, in which case, heard my case, said I awarded the boy to his grandma, and lo and behold, I became the family of my grandparents. And so I had two uncles, which were my brothers, and grandma and grandpa, which acted as my mom and dad. And I guess that makes me my own grandpa.
So were they also in Kansas, or was that when you, okay.
Yes, they were in on a farm in Kansas, about 5 miles out of town, and we were there my whole growing up life. Don't remember anything else. I do remember that I had attended one or two country schools, and then when I finally got settled in with my grandparents, I went to school on a bus. They called it the Consolidated School in town, which was a big brick school building, much like schools are today, primary schools. From first through sixth grade.
And so did you continue on with school after sixth grade, or was that when you went to work on the farm?
That's when I went to work on the farm, and I got big enough to do most of a man's work, and so that's what I did. I went on the farm and helped out with the chores there, did light horse work and a lot of hoe and shovel work and things like that. That's just what farm boys did in those days.
It's some kind of education.
Well, it is indeed an education. What it did, it instilled in me a natural desire or curiosity about things. And so I had an anxiety to learn and learn from every source that I could get my hands on. That bode well for the rest of my life.
So how old were you when you actually joined the service?
I was 21.
And were you still working on the farm at the time you decided to join the service?
The farm is another problem. It was Western Kansas and an area known as the Dust Bowl. And when the rain stopped and the drought began, along with the depression, the land that we're farming literally blew away. We stirred up the land with the plow and the cultivator, which we shouldn't have done, and instead of leaving it in buffalo grass. And it just, the wind picked it up and blew one day to Texas and the next day to South Dakota. And so when the farm finally blew away to where there was nothing left to farm with, just hardtack below the level of the plow, we decided that was maybe enough and gave it back to the banks and headed for Oregon. And that was the beginning of an adventure.
So the whole family moved to Oregon at that time?
It didn't quite happen as we planned it. My teacher, sixth grade teacher, she was a geography teacher, and my favorite subject was geography. And she was a fantastic teacher, but she told us about the milk and honey Oregon territory and how great it was. And of course, it created an interest in it. And we found out from other sources that people were going there. So we headed for Oregon in probably about 1935 or so. And we got as far as Fort Collins, Colorado. And Grandpa got sick and we couldn't travel anymore. And so we stopped. And of course, my uncles, being very ambitious, checked with a realtor to find out what was available. We found a timber ranch that was, I don't know if it was for sale, lease, or what. I was too disinterested in those types of things at that time. Never realized how we acquired it. But we became loggers and furnished timber for the mines in Colorado.
You had a lot of diverse experiences before you finally got to the Army.
Oh, definitely.
But you joined in 1942. The war had already started. Had the draft begun at that point?
Yes, draft began, and that's how I got it. I got caught in my draft.
So
I was I deliberately stayed out because I was needed to help with the timber ranch, and it was, in our opinion, somewhat a needed occupation during the war. The mines had to keep open and going, the ones that were operating at the time. And so we furnished railroad ties for the rail underneath the rails and props to hold the roof up and Christmas trees in the wintertime and so forth.
Wow. Okay. So often amongst the many questions that we get, people often like to ask Medal of Honor recipients how the Medal of Honor changed their lives. But you were only 23 when you were awarded the Medal of Honor. So
yeah,
you've worn that medal for 73 years.
Yeah, it was awarded in 45.
So 72 years you've had that.
Yeah, and it was in April or May or something like that. At least I was not yet 24 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you came back after the war then with this Medal of Honor, what did you do?
Well, first thing, going back to my family again in Oregon, while I was in Fort Meade, Maryland, training our final 13 weeks to go overseas, my folks moved to Oregon. Grandpa died while they were still in Colorado, and I was denied leave home because of the close proximity of shipping overseas. Nobody knew when. Anyway, while I was overseas, they moved to Oregon and established a farm south of Eugene, about 22 miles. And so that's where I went back to when I was discharged.
Okay. The way that you were raised, lots of hard work, family standing by family, no doubt instilled values in you. How did that come into play when you were in the Army? What were some of the challenges that you faced aside from being wounded in the war?
Well, the biggest challenges, I believe, was to make sure I kept up with what the status quo was. For example, in Sicily, we had a commander take over who believed that the 3rd Division could be as agile and long-lasting as a small commando unit, which he had established, the Rangers. And so he instituted what we call the Truscott Trot. It was 5 miles before breakfast every morning. Ooh. In 1 hour. And of course, we couldn't do that the first time we tried it. So we had to work till we could. And when we did, when that was accomplished, then we just kept doing that 5 miles an hour every morning before breakfast. And that was a good workout for the day. But that wasn't all. That just merely started the day. Got it rolling.
So when you weren't actually in combat, you spent a lot of time continuing your training?
Yes, we did. We continued, made sure we kept up the physical aspect, physical conditioning, and that was very important.
So training and commitment helped you get through what you were doing during the battle.
Yes, it helped. And it reflected back in a lot of long-range advances that we made during the war.
We have a student who wrote in and asked, how long did it take to get used to doing 5 miles in the morning before breakfast?
I don't recall the exact time, but I imagine we took weeks to develop that. Probably the first time we tried it, we had probably about half the division drop out the first day, but maybe about 4 miles. And then after a while, we moved it up to 4.5 miles and then 5. And finally, we accomplished the time in which we was required to do it. 5 miles is one thing, but doing it in 1 hour is something else. And so we had to develop that ability, and it took probably 2 to 3 months to fully develop it.
Did you get to a point where you appreciated the result of putting in all that work?
Yeah.
It paid off later?
It did pay off because we were able to move and catch the Germans napping a number of times. And of course, it reflected a lot on our endurance and ability to go. The war in Europe was quite different from the war in the Pacific because you traveled, instead of being bogged down in one place for a long length of time, we were on the go and kept the Germans moving, except for Anzio, and that was a different kind of a invasion.
You know, that insight is something that I think only those of you who were there can really share with the rest of us. I grew up studying about World War II, but I'd never really thought about that difference between being on an island and sort of locked in versus having the expanses of Europe. What do you think are some of the most important things that our students should know about World War II?
Well, realize that it's a war on two fronts. Vast differences in distance from between the European conflict and the Pacific conflict, mm-hmm. almost like as if two different wars going on at the same time. And the islands were entirely different a type of fighting than the mainland of Sicily and Italy. And southern France. The islands were a small concentration of the enemy and a very radical enemy that was bent on not allowing us to take over their territory. And they were willing to sacrifice anything, including their lives, to keep us from getting it. And take as many of us out as they could. The Germans were willing to pull back when times got rough and retreat was not a problem with them, it seemed like, at times. Although there were a few times that when we got into France, we had some difficulty in advancing in certain areas.
Interesting observations on how the geography made a huge difference in the way the battles were fought and their willingness. The Germans had room to move back, whereas the Japanese in the Pacific did not.
Yeah.
So you were in the war for a little over 2 years, I believe.
Yeah, about that.
And until your Medal of Honor action when you were wounded. And then you came back to the United States, is that right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And about 6 months later, you were awarded a Medal of Honor.
Yes.
And one of the students asked, was it a hard decision for you to throw yourself on that grenade?
Well,
I know we weren't going to talk too much about war, but I think students think about that.
It's a very difficult question, and I think it's something that he needed to ask, because he's probably the person asking is probably thinking, how would I do in a case like that? Well, you probably don't think about it. What's the alternatives? You can't get up and run. That would be fatal and be a disaster. You can't find the grenade to throw it back, for example, and that also would probably prove fatal, both to you and your companions. So what's left? Just drop and trust God for the rest.
Faith
was the biggest thing faith is something you got to practice. You know, you can't wait until you're in an emergency and then yell to God for help because, well, he's there, I know. But I think you if you keep a constant communication with him throughout your life, he's more likely to be available when you want him.
Well,
and that happened.
Okay. And that decision, I one time heard you ask this question, and I remember you saying that you didn't have any time to think about that decision.
That's true. Yeah.
Which I think probably goes back to your training as well and to your upbringing.
It could be, yeah. We were certainly trained to act quick in whatever situation we were. They realize that when the average hand grenade, when it's thrown, it may have seven or 8 seconds before it explodes. It travels through the air and lands, and then if you're lucky, you've got time to throw it back. But in this case, it was pitch dark. I couldn't find it, and if I'd have had my hand on it to throw it back, it would have exploded and would have been more disastrous than what happened. And so you have to think quick, and whatever you do, you got to do it now, not wait till later.
Some decisions you can't wait and think about, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm kind of jumping around a little here because we have questions coming in from all over the place. A lot of people are asking what your best messages would be for middle school students or high school students, but I think they'll fit in with some of these other questions. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, somebody asked if you wear your Medal of Honor every day.
No. No, I don't wear any identification to say that I'm a Medal of Honor recipient. But everybody in the McKinnon community knows about it now. For several years, most people didn't know about it until I started taking trips and they wondered why I was going. So naturally, we told them where we were going. And the conventions and the various events of the Medal of Honor Society, created a lot of interest in the medal. And then when I retired and moved to Bend, I found the person who, well, he found me, who was a veterans activist, and we both went to work and doing veterans benefits to veterans and veterans groups in Oregon, Central Oregon.
Now, when currently, piece of information for our viewers, currently there are 72 living Medal of Honor recipients. There are only 5 left from World War II at this point.
Oh, okay.
And but at the time that you were awarded your medal and shortly after World War II, there were several hundred Medal of Honor recipients.
Yes, that's right.
And so are things different now for Medal of Honor recipients than they were at the time you were awarded your medal? You think?
Well, we have 72,
mm-hmm.
72 members, and of course the majority of those are younger veterans from Korea, Vietnam, and the current conflicts in the Middle East, and every one of them deserving, every one of them has been thoroughly checked out by those who select the medal for the medal awards. And we have many many who have suffered greatly because of injuries during that Medal of Honor event that took place. And of course, I guess it's pretty well known that we're over 50% of the Medal of Honor recipients are posthumous.
Right. For our students who don't recognize that word, that means that the action for which the Medal of Honor recipient was awarded his medal resulted in his death. Right. So the medal was then passed to his family, not to him directly. Mm-hmm. So that has that since World War II, it's been that. The early medals during the Civil War, there were many more that were awarded to live recipients because there were not as strict rules until the early 20th century, and that's when the rules were really codified. But since from World War II forward, actually from World War I forward, it's been over 50% posthumous. So, and I think your average age now is in the 70s. And I noticed, boys and girls, that Mr. Maxwell referred to the younger guys. So those guys in their 70s.
Yeah, they're younger guys.
Yeah, there are a few that are under 40, but not very many.
Yeah.
A student just asked a question that I really like, and since I am asking questions, I get to choose the ones I like the best. Someone asked, besides the 5 miles, what was your everyday life like during World War II? Now, I know that you can't average them because you had some combat days and some non-combat days, but I think this student means non-combat days. What was
non-combat days was... well, we did a lot of practice firing our weapons to make sure that we were adept at hitting what we aimed at, and we always had one session of nearly always every day had one session of calisthenics, which kept us limbered up even after a 5 mile march. It kind of worked some of the stiffness out of our joints. And we practiced with whenever we were in an area of non-combat and bivouac, they call it, I guess, and reserve. Then we would practice with different combat tactics. And of course, my job, being a telephone wireman, was to keep up with the wire, make sure the wire communications were intact. And there's quite a lot of my time was spent in chasing down breaks in the wire to the rifle company or something like that. Yeah, I connected a rifle company to our switchboard every time we stopped. And then during the march, I went with a rifle company commander so that he'd have the telephone available at any time he wanted to stop and pull in fire control to help reduce a tough target ahead. There was so much of the time spent in actual combat that I think we didn't have a lot of time to think about what we're doing otherwise.
Okay.
And my job seemed to be pretty much continuous and this most every day, combat or no combat.
You know, that's interesting. I think that a lot of students, when they think about the context of war, are thinking about either fighting or not fighting. But what you've just shared with us is that there were actually everyday jobs that you had to do to keep the whole process going, even when you weren't in combat. And then as far as everyday life is concerned, dealing with a chance to get some sleep and to get some food. What were they feeding you in World War II?
Well, we had a lot of rations that we carry with us. C rations, K rations. Let's see, about the best thing I can think of in C rations is corned beef and hash, hard biscuits, and probably three cigarettes and a little pack of candy. And of course, we relied heavily on water to drink. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to put a fruit type drink in your canteen because it's aluminum. Then the heat comes, it gets hot. Ooh. So the aluminum flushes off into the drink and makes you sick.
Oh, yeah.
So, the canteen is just strictly used for water.
Strictly for water. That's a good piece of information right there.
I learned that by experience.
Whoops.
I put a lemon in my canteen one time.
Oh.
That lemon juice. It didn't work good.
I bet not. Now, you probably also had to, given that you were in North Africa, I'm sure you had to be very careful with the water. Did you manage to avoid malaria and things like that?
We had Adderin pills, which they forced us to take. If they didn't find us taking Adderin, you could check it with the color of your skin, whether you'd been taking it or not.
Wow.
Your skin would turn yellow. And if you're taking your Adderin, then you're safe from malaria.
Okay, good to know, because another thing that I think a lot of students aren't aware of is that disease took out an awful lot of servicemen because of being in places that we weren't used to, and also the danger not just from unclean water, but also from bugs. You mentioned that when you were in school that geography was your favorite subject, and then here you were suddenly leaving the plains, the Dust Bowl of Kansas, and getting to tour the world.
Yeah.
So you saw Africa, North Africa, and Sicily and Italy, and a good section of Europe. What were some of, did you have a chance to think about what it was like to be in these different cultures, or were you just too busy to pay attention to that?
I never thought much about it. I just observed some of the things that were going on. Africa was interesting because it was quite different from the other countries. A little farther backward than Italy and Sicily and France. And their mode of transportation was the donkey, traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd see a little bitty donkey with a great big tall African riding him and dragging feet on the ground and
oh my.
Switching his tail in. and had some kind of a word that he said to the donkey that only the donkey understood.
It was probably pretty dusty like Kansas, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they had the railroads were quite primitive. There were short trains and small locomotives, and they had what they called the 40-8 boxcar, which would contain 40 men or 8 horses. We traveled across North Africa on such a train, part of the way and part of the way on trucks, to move from Casablanca to Tunisia when we were called to go over there.
Wow, that's an interesting way to travel. 40 men, 40 and 8. I had no idea that referred to 40 men or 8 horses.
Yep.
Interesting approach. In this time of instant communication, we're sitting here talking to people as far away as Maine and Florida from here in the Northwest, and we all have had our cell phones sitting around us this morning, and we're in contact in all different ways, but you didn't have access to any of that during World War II. Were you able to stay in touch with your family at all, and did you hear from them?
Well, we had, the only contact we had was email, which you write your letter out on a piece of paper about the size that you see there, and then when they send it, they take a picture of that and reduce it down to very small.
It's about this size.
Yeah, about like that, or maybe even less.
Yeah. Went from an 8.5 by 11.
Right. Uh-huh. And then when it gets to its destination, they expand it back up again and send it to the people. That saved a lot of space and transportation across the ocean. And we never were in contact with any kind of visual or auditory means, no telephone. I think some people could call the home, but my folks lived on a ranch most of the time. The telephone hung on the wall, and we weren't particularly concerned about communication.
You were too busy.
Yeah.
Now, and the communication that did come through, I have some of that old V-mail that my grandmother got from my dad and his brothers when they were in World War II.
Oh, yeah.
And some of it actually came back in those little tiny pieces of paper.
Yeah.
But there were words marked out of them.
Oh, yeah. That's a sensor. If a sensor finds anything that might be of use to the enemy in locating your unit or telling who your unit is, or any identification of the unit was marked out, so that they tried to keep it secret as from the Germans, from the enemy, who the enemy were facing, because it was valuable to them.
So for your own safety, that censorship was not a matter of control. It was a matter of safety.
Yeah, it was a matter of safety for us, yeah.
Uh-huh. So on the other direction, did you ever get on the ground? Did you get much mail from home? And was your family ever able to send you, say, care packages or that sort of thing? Food or
I don't recall
Christmas cookies?
I don't recall getting any packages. But I got mail every once in a while, I think. Probably once a month we might have gotten some mail. That's about the average mail call time.
So it was pretty old news by the time you got it.
Yeah, some of it was, yeah.
None of this instant communication.
No.
One student asked, was waiting to fight a challenge? Were the downtimes challenging when nothing was going on?
Downtime
in between battles.
I
doesn't sound like you
well,
have a lot of in between.
It's a
time.
Lot of yeah, a lot of the downtime is spent in maintenance of equipment, which includes cleaning your rifle if you have one, and making sure that in communication we made sure the telephone, the switchboards were in good working order, and we spent a lot of time in going back to the rear and hauling up more wire because we used a lot of it. And this was...
That was your main communication, right?
Yeah, that was... for some reason, they felt that their telephone was a fairly secure communication, plus it... Once you tied the wire in from the battalion to the rifle company, it signified that you were there and established. You established a control of that particular territory. Because now with the telephone, the company commander can call in for any kind of assistance he needs that we have available, the air, artillery, heavy mortar, whatever is available in the company to help out to soften targets up.
So it was, that's interesting because that wired telephone service both provided a connection and lifeline. But it was also then more secure than what we have now with wireless because nobody could connect into
They couldn't tap into it. They could, but they'd have to get behind our lines to do so. And they could tap into the wire. And occasionally this happened, but it wasn't a common practice. And radio, we did have radios, but the only time we used radios in combat was primarily through a code of some kind and try to keep our activities unknown to the enemy, what we intended to do.
This is all such interesting historical information about the geography and your lifestyle and all that. And I'll sit and talk with you after we're done with this webinar, but I have a couple more questions that are, I think, very thoughtful questions. One student asked, do you think being in the Army changed you? And if so, how?
Oh, I don't think so. To me, it was just another job, but it, of course, it, it required a lot of exposure to dangers, which I didn't have at home in a regular job. You have danger of a tree falling on you, the horse running away with your load or something like that. But in there, your life is in danger. Whenever you hear a whistle, you got to make sure you hit the ground immediately, if not sooner.
Another time not to ask questions, yeah. Just make a decision.
Yeah, and that's the main difference. It's like another job, but it's a job that's quite dangerous.
Do you feel like you built up more courage the longer you were in the service?
Maybe so. Maybe a little more willing to take chances than at first. And I don't know, my job was warm and occupied so much of my time, I didn't think a whole lot about the war and the conflict other than what I could actually see of it happening. And of course, the company commander was, in our units, our company commanders were generally quite upfront with their troops. And so I did have a lot of chance to see the war in action and dodge a few bullets by hitting the ground and so forth.
To go back to, and I'm jumping around again, to your Medal of Honor, did you receive your medal at the White House?
After what?
Did you receive your medal at the White House? Did you go to the White House to get your medal? Where were you awarded your medal?
No, it's another story, but my citation was on President Roosevelt's desk, and he had his signature on it, but he died before it could be presented, so it was given to I happened to be in convalescent hospital in Colorado Springs, and it was given to General G.W. Danielson in Denver, Colorado. And his troops were ass in review and the whole ball of wax. And incidentally, it was also a posthumous Civil War was presented to another father and mother who had lost a son in Italy at the same time.
So that was in Colorado?
Yes, Denver, Colorado.
That's very different from now when the recipients are all brought home and taken to the hospital. I think a reflection on the difference of our times and the ease of travel, and also the whole country remained at war at the time that you were awarded your medal.
Yeah, and it's a time of a transition from one president to another, which is a very hectic time in Washington, I imagine, and getting things running, President Truman taking over from President Roosevelt.
And it was not the typical change because of a new inauguration of a president, but rather because President Roosevelt had passed away while still
right.
in office.
Yeah, there was no inauguration at that time.
That would have made things different. Do you remember? Did anything in particular run through your mind either at the time you were told that you were being awarded the medal or at the time that you actually received the Medal of Honor?
Oh, I kind of wondered why. And then when I received a citation, it told me the answer to those questions. And I don't know. I don't know that I guess it was something that I just accepted with, along with other things in life. And,
do you have any idea the kinds of, by the way, I want to say hello real quick to, we've got a message that says, hi, Grandpa, looking good, love you. Oh, so your grandkids are, Jordan, hi, Jordan. Thank you for watching. And I think that's so important because Medal of Honor recipients are regular people like the rest of us. They just represent the very best of us. And what a privilege it is to be here with you today. Thank you for that. You know, you're saying that the medal was just something that you accepted, but you know, I've noticed that some people refer to the medal as being kind of a weight to carry, a little bit of a burden and a responsibility. How do you feel about that?
I fully feel that weight, yes. Now, that is true. That, and I think back to the time when it happened. There were three wiremen and a radio operator behind the wall in front of the command post. All of us with 45 automatic pistols firing over the top of the wall. Above the wall was a screen. Kind of a chicken wire screen. I don't know why it was there, but it was handy. And we were firing at muzzle flashes in the dark because when we found out the Germans were headed our way, they had infiltrated through the rifle companies. And I feel that those boys sticking with the job and hanging in there deserved medals, every one of them, because they were in defense against impossible odds. The only thing that saved us was possibly we made enough noise to slow the Germans down so the command post could be evacuated right behind us. And as soon as the command post was evacuated, they all got up and left, and I was out with the grenades, so I didn't know anything was going on. And I believe that those men certainly deserved the medal. And Lieutenant Johnson, my platoon commander, the communication platoon commander, was in the house taking the wire off the phone, getting ready to pull back. And he saved my life because I wouldn't have got out of there without his help. So we did a three-legged sack race to the back, to the rear.
So they got you up and moving after you threw yourself on that grenade?
Well, I got up by myself. Most of the command post thought I was dead. And so they immediately evacuated, and which is good because you got everybody out of the way. So I was left there for, but anyway, when I came to, I thought maybe I'd better try to find a way out, and I couldn't do it by myself.
Well, I'm sure glad he was there to help you out. You know, I think that something that a lot of students don't are not very much aware of is that we did not have helicopters in World War II. And as much as we see terrible, terrible injuries from the current conflicts and from Vietnam, many of people who had those injuries in World War II died on the battlefield because there was no way to get them out, except for people like Bob, his peers, and the people who helped pull him out. So that speaks to the tenacity of the American serviceman and his willingness to risk his life to help each other. So I'm so glad, obviously, that he did that. students from Loyal Middle School and Pinon Mesa Middle School and many, many other schools wanted to say thank you for you being here and talking with us today. We have time to squeeze in a couple more questions. Someone asked, what message would you have for today's youth and how they can lead and serve in their communities? Most of them will never go into the military, but there are certainly lots of things that they can do at home. Do you have suggestions, and maybe also suggestions on what they can do to show respect for veterans? You said you're involved.
One of the first things would be to thank them for this participation in this event, and to continue with all other activities like this, because you're in a period of concentrated learning. The first few years of your life is you're constantly learning day after day after day, no matter where you are or what you're doing, and keep up that desire to learn, and learn all you can. One of the important things in everyone's life, and that is a faith in a higher authority. You believe in God, and of course the Bible says if you believe in God, believe in Jesus, our Savior, and those are things which sustain you not only in this life but in the life to come. And it gives you some security and also a good outlook on life. And if you get a chance to go to college, go, if it's possible to finance it. And there are a number of ways you can do that now. If you do choose military service, it's an honorable profession, and the military does an awful lot for the world. American military, constantly helping people as well as fighting enemy, and you see from the current conflict with the storms right now in Texas, the military is right there. One of the first groups called is National Guard and active military. And wherever there's trouble in the world, the military is one of the first lines of defense. And if you choose to go into any other profession like police work, you're the first line of defense against crime in the country. And that's one of the most honorable professions other than military. I don't know where to go from there.
Well, my gosh, that was days worth of advice in about 2 minutes. But I'm hearing some recurring themes. I'm hearing service and education, mm-hmm. and the commitment, those values that you grew up with. And thank you, by the way, Mr. Maxwell has been very involved with the Medal of Honor Foundation's Character Development Program, which was commissioned by the Medal of Honor Society. This is a Medal of Honor recipients program, and he's been fundamental in getting that started here in Bend, Oregon. But I want to really emphasize too his appreciation for education. You just mentioned go to college if you can. When we started this hour, you mentioned that you had to leave school about sixth grade because you went to work on the farm, and that was not at all unusual. At that time, but coming up on through the Dust Bowl and into the Great Depression, survival was much more important than being in a classroom at the time. Yeah, but I want to point out to our students that Mr. Maxwell did indeed finish high school, that he graduated with the 2011 class of Bend High School, even mm-hmm. though he had already spent a career teaching college. So he has an ongoing dedication to education.
Yeah.
So we appreciate that greatly. And I also want to say, you know, you have reached that point in your life where you get to brag about how old you are. And I think that is absolutely wonderful. You just mentioned a positive outlook. Thank you for that. You are such a beautiful example for all of us that What a positive outlook and a good approach toward life can do. And so thank you for that. Do you have anything you want to offer to our students before we wrap this up today?
No, but I wanted to, you kind of hit on it when you reflected back on my life, that I used every possible means of education that I could find. And you know, I was working as a mechanic, and they asked me to come and teach school. Now, how do you move from that profession to this profession when you needed acres and acres of education to get into teaching? And so I said, no, we'll do it this way. We'll give you credit for the mechanical work that you've done, because you've learned a lot there, with a lot that school would give you, and get the GED, which I did. And then I enrolled in summer school at Corvallis while teaching in the winter in Bend. And then also when we moved to Eugene, I was still doing summer school in Corvallis. And so I was being educated with the requirements of my profession all the time I was teaching.
That is wonderful. What a great, there you go, kids. If you want one outstanding lesson that comes out of this, use all your different opportunities to add up to not be obstacles, but rather to be opportunities.
Yes.
Thank you so much. We're going to close this up today because we're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you, students and teachers, for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
Please, anybody who's on there, students and teachers alike, the Medal of Honor Foundation website is www.themedalofhonor.com. Make sure you put in the at the beginning of that. And on there, you can access living histories, both Mr. Maxwell's and another 114 Medal of Honor recipients who recorded, starting in 1999, their stories. So you can watch those. That all counts. Teachers and students alike, that is primary material for you to use. You can use that in research papers and cite those materials. You can learn more about Medal of Honor recipients, and you can also access the entire character development program lesson plans, and you can see about our next webinars.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.